for the opportunity to speak here. What I will tell you today is about some method using the kinetic equation that we developed, me together with my PhD advisor, Alexander Finkelstein, which is very useful for calculation of thermal transport in general, and I will use the example of Nernst effect in the vicinity of superconducting transition in order to introduce the method. Now, if you have any question during the talk, you're more than welcome to ask during the talk or in the end. Now, the main motivation for our work was coming from measurement of Nernst effect in ITC material. Just to remind, what is the Nernst effect? So if you are looking at a sample, a gradient of temperature is applied along the sample. Magnetic field is applied perpendicular to the sample. Here it is a three-dimensional one. And the voltage across the sample is measured. So it is very similar to the setup of Nernst of all effects, but instead of voltage applied along the sample, as in the case of the all effect, here we apply gradient of temperature, some difference of temperature between the two sides. Now, in ITC material, on from Princeton, as measured, and now already other people followed him, measured the Nernst effect above the transition temperature of the ITC superconductors into the pseudo gap. So if you are looking here at the phase diagram, temperature and doping of ITC materials, here it is lanthanum, strontium, copper oxide, but they see it in all others. You can see here it is the superconducting dome. Here is the pseudo gap temperature where electrons start to be gapped, and they obtain a large Nernst signal starting from the vicinity and even lower than TC, going way up close to the pseudo gap temperature, but not exactly following the pseudo gap. You can see that while the pseudo gap goes up, the Nernst effect seems to just follow the superconducting dome. Their explanation, what they argue, is that if we consider the picture in which TC is where gap remain finite, but there are phase fluctuations, vortices proliferate, then this entire Nernst signal is due to the motion of vortices. Basically, if we have vortices in the system, we apply a gradient of temperature, vortices will prefer to form at the hotter side, just because it is easier to be created due to the excess temperature. But in order to make the entropy larger, they will start to flow to the colder side. If I'm thinking of vortex as just magnetic flux, motion of magnetic flux is just creating EMF force, and that will create a voltage across the sample. So that is the reason why they believe they see the Nernst effect. So, and there are several theoretical calculations that actually predict what should be the power dependence of the Nernst effect due to vortices as a function of temperature, as a function of magnetic field. So that was our motivation to try to understand that. But then we actually discover that it has nothing to do with ITC materials. Here there's measurement done on niobium silicon films in the Camman-Benial group in France. Niobium silicon is completely conventional superconductor. Here it is small films of the niobium silicon. And you can see here measurement of the Nernst signal as a function of both temperature and magnetic field. This is the line of TC, so you can see a huge signal inside the superconducting phase, which is indeed coming from vortices, as maybe yes, maybe not, in the case of ITC, depending on whether we believe this picture. But we can see that the Nernst signal extends. They can measure it here. They measure it up to 6-7 times TC. They actually have also measurement where they can measure it up to 20 times DC. So basically they see some nerve signal at 20 times DC before it goes to some basically zero.
But the bulk DC of niobium is about 7 or 8 Kelvin. Yes. So it's always below that.
No. So the point is that it is not,
so this is
film niobium, it is not bulk. And it's niobium silicon also.
And also only 0.15 niobium, the rest is silica.
Exactly. So it is basically silica doped with niobium. Mm. And the fact that niobium, it almost has zero relation to the superconductivity of niobium, besides of the fact that it is phonon mediated.
And so it's niobium doped silica. That's
yes, there are no, definitely there are no above the transition. It's not that part of your Fermi surface is gapped. Everything, it might be that close to the transition, you will have some phase fluctuation and proliferation of vortices, but it won't survive to twice DC even. They can look at all kinds of features of the transition, and it's quite sharp transition, if they are looking at resistance, for example.
So you're assuming that this is the homogeneous, acts like the homogeneous sample,
so
it doesn't have small inclusions of niobium, which would not be enough to make the sample superconducting, but probably, maybe it wouldn't give a Nernst effect, though, in that case, if you had.
You're asking whether if I will have some kind of island.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if that would give you a nurse.
It depends how far the islands will sit apart, whether it will be like Josephson Junction.
Presumably they would be far apart enough not to make it look like a superconducting sample.
So in order to make it look like a superconducting sample, then it should be small enough to have tunneling current, to have something like Josephson Junction. And then indeed the transition will be first that each grain will be superconducting, and then you will have phase fluctuation. When they are looking at, and that can be detected, like whether the system is more granular or homogeneous, it can be detected, they can look at the morphology, but and how much amorphous is the film, but they can also look, for example, a simple thing is resistance. They can look at the resistance measurement of the transition and how sharp it is. And if the resistance drop at a range of temperature which is much smaller than TC, for example, that is a good indication that the system is amorphous. And these are quite well known to be amorphous films. So conventional, in terms of superconductivity, the pairing is conventional. It is phonon mediated. They are amorphous. Their TC is quite low because it is quite disordered system. So that's what makes TC to be so small. And the question is, how can they get such long range in temperature of Nernst effect? And in the same way, they can go also with magnetic field. So they're going roughly to 5 times the critical field. And again, they still can detect the Nernst signal. And Phil, if you.
So what are those blackouts?
What?
Blackouts.
That one. You mean? Okay, so if they are looking at the Nernst signal as a function of magnetic field for various temperatures, so basically that is the temperature closest to TC, but still higher than TC and going up, they are tracing the position of the peak of the Nernst effect. So it is always going up and then going down. There is some maximum for the Nernst signal, and they are basically tracing it. And what they want to claim is that it is related to the coherence length outside of the superconducting phase. So basically, they want to say that the decay or the general behavior of the Nernst effect is related to superconductivity. That's the reason. And what they were suggesting that if, in the case of ITC, we can argue that indeed in the region between TC and the pseudo gap, there are many vortices and phase fluctuation. Here we cannot no longer believe that there are phase fluctuation above, let's say, twice TC if I want to be generous. But actually, if we have something like Costa-Tauis transition in this system, it should be very close to TC. So let's say going maybe 10% of TC, I can understand as phase fluctuation, vortex fluctuation. So, but we do know that there are order parameter, or what we usually call Gaussian fluctuation, above the transition. And the question is whether they can explain this NERV signal. And if do, why it still keep on at such relatively high temperature, which of 20 times TC. But before I'm going into the fluctuation correction, the question is, why can it be quasi-particles? And usually, when we were talking to people and asking them why can it be quasi-particle, most people say Nernst effect is like all effect. So if you have particle all symmetry and Fermi liquid system as the normal state of these materials is roughly particle all symmetry, and then, like in the all effect, there should be cancellation due to particle all symmetry. So we wanted just to have more general understanding of the Nernst effect, just to see whether it's correct. So we were using not what I will describe later, our more complicated quantum kinetic equation, but just Boltzmann kind of end waving calculation for. And we can look at, so let us look at two kind of particles, electrons and all, where the only difference between them will be the charge. So mass is the same, all other features are the same, just the sign of the charge. And we can do the relaxation time approximation, assuming that they have the same relaxation, and write the difference in the distribution function coming from the coupling to the gradient of temperature, and the Lorentz force coming from the magnetic field. And we can look now at what is first, let's say, our electric current derived from that, but let's look first at the longitudinal current. We can see that the longitudinal current is just the sum over the two contributions coming with a different charge. Now, in order to see whether it is basically due to particle all symmetry cancelled or not, we need to look how many powers of the charge we have. When we are connecting something to gradient of temperature, it doesn't matter whether there are electrons or all. It doesn't couple to the charge. So clearly, the longitudinal part of the current is going to be cancelled due to particle all symmetry. But now what happens when we introduce our Lorentz force and try to push the current from the longitudinal direction to the transverse direction? Now we will have two powers of the electric charge, one from the current, from the definition of the current, the other one from the cyclotron frequency. So basically, when we have electrons and all, and they are both pushed in the same direction by the temperature gradient, the magnetic field will turn them in opposite direction, so the total current will be additive because they have opposite signs. So actually, there is no such cancellation for quasi-particles, but we can now, ask what is the expression here, whether it's still zero or non-zero for the case of the Nernst effect. And if we are in Fermi liquid, we can assume that our density of state and our velocity, they are all independent of the momentum near the Fermi surface. And now we can see that what we are getting under this approximation of constant density of state of electrons near the Fermi surface is that we have some odd integral that indeed will vanish. So the reason actually why quasi-particle do not contribute in regular Fermi liquid, which we cannot say for other systems like the ITC materials, is not because of particle all symmetry, but because they have constant density of state. And in order to have non-zero Nernst effect, we need some imbalance in the density of state. That is, of course, only approximate. If in the end we will take correction to the density of state, saying that it's not completely constant, we can see that the Nernst effect will be proportional to omega c tau, the cyclotron frequency times the relaxation time, very similar to all effect, or exactly the same, but also temperature over the Fermi energy, which is coming from the fact that it is thermal measurement of thermal transport. And these two coefficients are very small. there is no reasonable way to assume that what we see next to this, the large effects next to the superconducting transition is coming from these quasi-particles, just because it will be much, it is expected to be much smaller, and they don't see this effect when they are going to higher temperature. It's not that it grows with temperature. It actually decays after a while. So what can be other contribution? If you want to, something that won't have constant, approximately constant density of state, that is where fluctuation of some can be important. We can think about two types of fluctuation. There can be neutral fluctuation, for example, Coulomb interaction related, but since they are neutral, they don't have charge, they cannot be turned by the magnetic field. So they can contribute to properties like the longitudinal thermal transport, longitudinal conductivity, but we know that they don't contribute to the Hall effect, and they don't, in the same way, they are not going to contribute to the Nernst effect. But on the other end, fluctuation of the superconducting order parameter are charge fluctuation. We can think about it as a temporary pairing of two electrons. Temporary just because we are above the transition, so it costs energy, so they will have finite lifetime. And these can actually contribute to the Nernst effect. Now, if you want to ask what is the quantity that we want to look at, so we can look at the conductivity tensor, electric current and thermal current as a function of the electric field and gradient of temperature, and these are the four conductivities. In order to find the Nernst signal, it is the connection between the field in one direction and the gradient of temperature in another direction, so it is some combination of the Peltier coefficient and the resistivity. Now, that one thing which is not general property of this Nernst coefficient, but it is indeed correct for these superconducting materials, is that the second term is much smaller than the first contribution. And that is because when we are looking at the thermal, longitudinal thermal transport, as we explained, if we have this kind of particle Hall symmetry, it is going to be canceled, really canceled, not approximately. Same is true for the Hall conductivity. And therefore, because of that, we expect that these two parameters together will have smallness that doesn't exist in the case of the Nernst and the longitudinal conductivity. And indeed, on the same material, they were measuring the Nernst signal for two different values of the magnetic field. They compare that with the Hall angle and the thermal power, which is basically the second term. And they can see that in all relevant temperature of the measurement, it is time 2000, so it is at least three orders of magnitude smaller. So actually, we can reduce our calculation of Nernst to calculation of the longitudinal conductivity, which is more or less constant above the transition for this material, and calculation of the transverse Peltier coefficient. So now we can ask ourselves, okay, we need this transverse Peltier coefficient. We are looking at weak superconductivity, and we know that all this kind of fluctuation correction, we can just take Kubo formula, put everything inside, expand that in the interaction, have all these assumptions of Larkin, Mackey-Thompson, and this class of contribution, and that's it. So why it is quantum kinetic and all the large title that I have in the beginning. So the question is whether Kubo formula actually holds when we are looking at thermal transport. So just to compare what we are doing when we are looking at Kubo formula for electrical conductivity. So basically, we are writing, and I'm following Luttinger argument. There are many ways to formulate the Kubo formula, but that is one of them. We are looking at some time, starting time infinity, at the density, at our density matrix without any external field, of the system without any external field. Then we start to apply, gradually turn on here, scalar potential. we can write the equation of motion for the density matrix and the continuity equation for the density in order to extract the current and connect the average current to the current-current correlation function. Now, as we know, if we want to find not the conductivity, but the response for non-homogeneous chemical potential, what we know from Einstein kind of construction of the Einstein relation is that we can, since chemical potential is not mechanical force, we cannot plug it into the Cooper formula, we can go in the different direction. We can make our system to have some electrochemical potential, which is our non-uniform chemical potential, and some field that we apply, some scalar field that we apply. In that way, there is no average current. But if we know to calculate the response, the current that is created by the scalar potential, we can connect it to the opposite current, which is compensated coming from the non-uniform chemical potential or the non-uniform density, which is the same. And that's what gives us Einstein relation. So now what happens when we are coming to calculate response to gradient of temperature? It is again similar to the chemical potential. We do not have actually any mechanical force that we can put and say, okay, that will be in our Hamiltonian, that will give us our equation of motion, the same as we did when we had our scalar potential.
Oh, usually can you couple it to external metric, so the curvature in the time component.
Yeah, okay, so that's what we are doing. But that is actually using some similar tricks. So, but that is important ingredient here, that we cannot calculate directly the response to temperature gradient. We can calculate response to some other mechanical force and connect between the two. So no, but that is correct. And we are using that. And that was first, at least as the way that I know that, suggested by Lattinger. Might be something earlier, but. And what Lattinger is suggesting, okay, have some force that is coupled to the Hamiltonian density, to the energy. Now we can again repeat the same procedure. Look at our equation of motion for the density matrix. Look at the continuity equation and basically find the heat current, which is response as response to the this. What he was calling gravity force, and it makes sense just because it is coupled to the energy. But it's a very simplified version of, I would say, gravitational force. Now, we can use similar to the argument of Einstein relation. We can make the current vanish by applying both our gravitational force and gradient of temperature. And using, basically, since we are now all the time at equilibrium, we can use thermodynamic identities and connect between the coefficient relating the current to the gravitational force and the coefficient relating the current to the gradient of temperature. So there is a way to write Cooper formula. So that is not why we didn't do that. But now, as we said, the Cooper formula is about the current-current correlation function. So what is the current that we need to plug in into the Cooper formula? We know that when we add, basically, when we have electric current, so the current is the bare current that we are starting with, is just the momentum. And in order to find that, similar to this procedure that we did here, we can use our density, not only the density average with the density matrix, and use the continuity equation to find what is the current operator. And this current operator, it doesn't matter for it whether we have interaction or we don't have interaction, just because the density is commuting with the interaction part that is some function of the density. But that is not correct for the thermal current. Oh, I'm going back. What Lattinger actually showed us, that if we are doing this kind of procedure of asking what is the current operator for energy current, for thermal current, we need to start with Hamiltonian density, use the continuity equation, and extract what is the current. And if we have interaction, it can be written in, divided into two terms. That one is, I would say, the naive current. It is the Hamiltonian density, the energy density per particle times their current, their velocity. But here we have a part which is very complicated function of the interaction. And if you think about that, the interaction should somehow enter the current because I can have thermal current without any motion of particles. Most simple example is, let's say that I have some spin interaction and I'm flipping spin somewhere here and only the energy is transferred because now the spin in some other direction feel that. But no, there was no real motion of particles in the system. So it is not only related to real current of particles, but also to the interaction between them. Of course, if I will take short-range interaction, there will be no derivatives, and this term will fall. But in most realistic systems, we don't have only short-range of interaction. And definitely, when we are looking at the superconducting fluctuation, they are not short-range. So the question is, okay, how really to treat this kind of term? And that was quite a puzzle because if I'm starting with this kind of term in the Cooper formula, we can get all kind of the many diverging terms. We do believe that if we will sum them, we will get something which must be finite. But it's not clear how to regularize this term. I can tell you what other people, we are not the first one that realize that there is these kind of terms. That is actually still from Latinger paper, but in many cases, what people are doing are basically doing, okay, I don't know how to use that. We are not going to use this term. We are going to approximate our current only by the more natural version of the current. And then if indeed we are writing that, then the current is very simple and intuitive. Because if we have electric current, we will have the particle current times which has the charge of the electrons in this case or any kind of particles. If we have energy current, we'll just multiply it by the energy, the particle current times the energy. But the question is, obviously it is not the entire current coming from the continuity equation. Question, how long is it? So that was the zero question that we asked ourselves, how long it is to use this simplified version, let's call it, of the Cooper formula, not the complete one, the one that we know how to treat. So what we did, we were taking this current, this part of the current, the simplified version, and say, okay, we can try to do microscopic calculation of the Cooper formula for Fermi liquid system. We definitely know that in simple Fermi liquid system, we must get that the Wiedemann-Franz law is obtained. Because in Fermi liquid, everything is in terms of quasi-particle, and as long as we have only current of quasi-particles, it must obey the Wiedemann-Franz law. So we were testing that, and already, if I'm, as I said, just doing Fermi liquid calculation, using not the exact current vertex, but the simplified one, and we are getting the data that violate the Wiedemann-Franz law, and are not small by any parameter. So obviously, even in the simple example, it is wrong. So we cannot really trust this method when we are going to something more complicated.
So the simplified assumption is that the particle current and the energy current kind of are proportional to each other?
So no. So we were assuming that the particle, what that one, if you are calling that the particle current, is much more important from the other term, which is also particle current, but it is dominant by the interaction. You can see it is the part, I will say, of the current which doesn't depend on real motion of particles, really that the particles will go from one side of the sample to the other side of the sample, but on the fact that you can polarize your system in one side and feel the energy flow to the other side.
Phonon transport in ordinary solid is of that type.
Phonon?
Phonon transport. Because
so
you don't have real motion of atoms. Only vibrations get transferred.
So I can think about phonon transport indeed in similar way, that you're creating some local change in one side of the sample, let's say phonon, kind of density change in one side, and you are getting some kind of energy transfer to the other side. And but if you will look at how many electrons were jumping from one side of the system to the other one, we know that phonons also exist in completely insulating system. It's not related to the fact that the system is conducting. As I said, I can think about other example as if I have insulating magnetic system, but with long range spin interaction. I'm changing the spin, flipping one of the spins, and I'm looking at all spins will feel the effect of that, which means that some energy is transferred along the system by this interaction. So that is the way that I can interpret the difference between the two terms, because here I see that there is actually need for motion. It will be very, if the system is insulating and there is no electric current in the system, this term should be zero, but not the other one.
But the Wiedemann Franz law naively doesn't seem to care about these fancy effects of phonon transport.
So Wiedemann Franz law holds, and in most cases it doesn't, as long as you can approximate nicely your system as quasi-particles, which is coming from the first term.
Yeah.
And Fermi liquid is exactly that. Fermi liquid is saying that I don't care of all this complicated interaction, I only care about the effective quasi-particle description. So what I was trying to see whether I'm getting Wiedemann-Franz law. And I was saying, so we were doing something which is mixture, because we were not doing phenomenological Fermi liquid calculation, we were doing microscopic calculation. And just keeping the terms which are Fermi liquid kind of terms. So usually it is not needed, this kind of calculation. But we wanted to test our expression that will go inside the Kubo formula for the most simple case where we are sure that we know what is the result. Clearly, if I will take non-interacting electrons, this question is not important because anyway there is no interaction. So that was the most simple example that I can think of which involve interactions. Well, I can just test, just to use this expression as a test. So, and what we see is that we know that if we are doing this kind of microscopic calculation of the Fermi liquid using Kubo formula, we do have interaction. We have dressing of interaction inside our expression. And once we include them, and not including this term, which is the same order in the interaction, we are getting some contributions which are just fake, which are wrong. That if we will know how to deal with this term and all these spurious divergences that we see there, they must cancel. But on a practical level, we don't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you mean something like taking the derivative with respect to the metric? Yes. So you will get the same. And the reason, if you think about that, is that there will be some complicated part about how to have interaction if you want to write really some field theory with the metric. In order to write local field theory, you need to use some mediating field for the interaction. And now you won't have only one metric in this quartic term. You have two, because you have two coordinates in general. So actually, if you think about each time that you have interaction and you have additional integral, you have additional metric. So unlike electric field that can come only in very specific places, the metric comes everywhere. Each time that you have additional contribution of the interaction, you can have additional way to extract this metric. So in general, yes. So you see that it is derivative here. So if I will take short range, very short range interaction, this term is not important. And also from the general argument that I cannot transfer energy if I don't have motion of particles, I cannot transfer energy if I have only short range interaction. It must have some long range component. So yeah.
So the Wigman-Franz law requires you to have some knowledge of the charge transport as well.
Yes.
And so you're confident that your error couldn't be in that channel when you don't recover.
So basically, since we're doing now at least Fermi liquid calculation, and we definitely know that in order to get the correct charge transport in the case of Fermi liquid, we just need to take this term, but instead of the Hamiltonian density, just have the charge of the particle. I don't think that, unless what we are actually saying is that Kubo formula doesn't work also for regular transport, but there, I would believe it more as A, because here I know that something, I don't think there is nothing wrong in the derivation of the Kubo formula. At least, I don't think so. And from the derivation of the Kubo formula for electric current, we definitely see that it's only this term with the charge.
There's no interaction terms.
There are no interaction. So in the case of the Bell vertex, there are no interaction entering the Bell vertex. Of course, there are a normalization coming from the interaction. But in Fermi liquid, we know exactly how, we have all the control parameters to make this kind of calculation. And so it seemed to be that the only wrong thing that we did was to forget about this term. Only, I don't know if to call it only, but that seemed to be where the problem is. Unless, I would say, there is something more in general wrong with all transport derivation. But if we believe regular transport theory, that will be where we are making the mistake. Okay, so that is one problem. Another problem, which is more unique to the Nernst effect, is related to the question of how magnetization enter the expression for the Nernst current. And it actually has a long long discussion along the history, starting from Abbasov at 67 and up to, I would say, nowadays, how magnetization enters the transverse thermal current. And the logic is as follows. If I'm looking at the differential heat, which is just the end, I have magnetic field, it is not only the energy or the energy in the grand canonical ensemble, it also has a part which is include the magnetization. Now if I will look at what is the heat current, so it's derivative of dq with respect to dt, and extracting the current out of the continuity equation, there is some contribution related to the magnetization. And if we are doing something like the Kubo formula, then we cannot write magnetization as some kind of correlation function. Spin, that will give us susceptibility. It is not magnetization. Or any other property, or here, orbital, we are looking at orbital magnetization, so angular momentum, that is again the susceptibility and not the magnetization. So, and in general, we don't have it in the Kubo, we don't have it directly in the current in the Kubo formula. So, what people were suggesting, okay, calculate Kubo formula for the part without the magnetization and then add the magnetization. But each one of them have a different way of adding the magnetization. Sometimes it's adding, sometimes it's subtracting. So it is not clear how to systematically treat the magnetization. So after all that, we will decide that Kubo formula can be very useful when we have simple system or electric conductivity, but we want to have some different way. Yeah.
I thought these magnetization currents don't contribute to actual transport, because they can be thought as bound currents, not transport currents.
So that is, I would say, that is that argument of Alperin. So the fact that they are bound, like, even if I can attribute them to the surface transport, some boundary current, there is no reason that they won't contribute. If I'm looking at, basically, I can look at that from other direction. I have a temperature gradient, and I'm applying magnetic field and looking at what is the current. when we have regular current, transverse current, and we can write it as part which is just coming from continuity equation and some curl of M. Right? So there is something. It might be small and it might be negligible, but I cannot forget it. Now I definitely know that if I will have temperature, which is changing in space, my magnetization roughly will change with the temperature. Let's say if I assume some local equilibrium. So all this kind of subtraction or not subtraction, I would say that just if I'm looking at the definition of the current, it should be there. And I can say that it's actually quite important that they will be there, because when we are looking at, I will discuss it later, when we are looking at something like heat currents, they are related to entropy, flow of entropy. So they must go to zero at zero temperature. And if you are not correctly look at the magnetization, you are getting violation of the third law of thermodynamics. So it might be that in specific system, it might be correct that magnetization is not very important. But I cannot say it as a general statement. Because even if it is, I can ascribe it to the boundaries of the system.
Yeah, no, it is there. I mean, I was just wondering whether it actually continues to actually transport. And it's there, no question.
So you're asking whether it can go out to the leads. So, but if I'm looking at something like, okay, now it's a question whether I'm looking at thermal transport. Let's say that I don't want to look at, I want to look at the difference in temperature which is created when I'm pushing some current. So then you're asking whether it is dissipative or not dissipative, right? Whether it can change the temperature or cannot change the temperature. So now I would say, I can say that it's a matter of interpretation. You can say that by looking at the current like that, I'm actually making the, I'm subtracting the contribution of magnetization. I'm looking, that is the definition of the transport current. And you can ask, in Maxwell equations, when I'm looking at Maxwell equation, that is the definition of the actual current, the total current, that if I will come, I will measure. So you can ask, I can ask the same question when I'm looking at Maxwell equations. What is this current? And it is going to contribute. It indeed depends, of course, whether your magnetization is coming from itinerant or localized moment. Magnetization of localized moment won't contribute, but magnetization of itinerant particles can contribute. So in order to circumvent all these problems, we were looking at the quantum kinetic approach. We are, of course, not the first one to look at the quantum kinetic approach, even not in the context of thermal measurement, but what we were trying to develop was slightly different. We were trying to get everything out of the action and the continuity equation related to the conservation law coming from the action. So basically, what we are doing is that we can write our continuity equation, not in terms of operators, but in terms of the Green function. And in particular, we are working with the Keldysh Green function, Keldysh ensemble of Green functions. And then, using the continuity equation, we can extract what are the expression for the current. And we can see now, unlike the previous case, that when we are looking at both the electric and the heat current, they have very similar part, which is just the renormalized velocity and the renormalized Green function, including already all interactions and the external fields. And the only difference is what is the charge, I can say, that's carried by the current. It can be the actual charge, the electric charge, or it can be the energy of this particle. Now, if we are going to a system like Fermi liquid system, where we can actually consider the Green function as quasi-particle Green function, we can see that unlike previously, when everything's set in the bare vertex, now it sits already after the renormalization of the vertex, and we will get immediately the Wiedemann-Franz law for only for Fermi liquid is fulfilled. When we are going for even it's enough that we've already soldered to Fermi liquid to violate the Friedmann-Franz law. And that we can obtain already here also. So that was one nice thing about our expression for the current, that it's quite compact, although all the complications are actually inside this parameter, and we can see the equivalence between electric and heat current. But now we need to find what is our Green function in response to some external our external temperature gradient. So again, there is the question of how to insert temperature gradient into our system. And since we are looking at our Keldysh Green function, and we assume that we are starting a thermal equilibrium before, or in that case, we assume that we are starting with our thermal equilibrium, we know that we have the part in our time, in our Keldysh time contour, which is just giving us the equilibrium distribution, the thermal distribution, and there is the time, which is just parallel to the real axis, which is giving us the real time evolution of the Green function. So now, what happens if we want to put the temperature to be dependent on space? The only place where the temperature enters is from this short leg that gives us the thermal distribution. So we can think about, if we assume some local equilibrium, that we will have the same thermal weight, but our boundary of this integral that gives us the thermal weight will depend on the coordinate. But, and then we have the other part, which is determined by quantum kinetic equation, but we don't have any external force now, so it will be a relatively simple one. But as a result of that, what we were doing is shifting the complication of the Kubo formula and its own complication by needing to solve some thermal distribution function with non-local temperature. And that is actually, there is nothing positive about that. But we can now again use the trick of the method. So let us plug in our metric. We have a very simple one. We don't need the entire component. We just need to wait to have a weight for our temperature. And we choose it in such a way that on the boundary, it will just cancel the coordinate dependence of the temperature. So now, basically what we will do is that we will start with a real equilibrium with the uniform boundaries, so we can write our thermal distribution function. And we will go to real time, we will slowly turn off this mechanical field, our gravitational field, and what will be left will be the response to the temperature gradient, to the temperature dependent, the coordinate dependent temperature. And by that, we are implementing this Einstein prescription, but now with our temperature gradient and not chemical potential. Same thing can be done also for the chemical potential if we wish. We can apply now in addition scalar potential and do in such a way that we will have here regular thermal equilibrium with no special dependence and then turn off the scalar potential in order to see the effect of non-uniform chemical potential or density. Okay, so now the formulation of the entire problem is, although the idea is quite simple, formulation can be slightly messy, so let me just highlight a few things which are specific for the Nernst effect, but we can learn about the general method from them. So since in the vicinity of the superconducting transition, we not only have quasi-particle, we can look also at the fluctuation field. We will need to write two Green functions, one for the quasi-particle, one for the fluctuation field, and just derive two kinetic equations, one for the quasi-particle degrees of freedom and one for the fluctuations. And of course, they are going to be coupled because they are interacting. And specifically here, we are considering only the RPA contribution to the propagator, to the propagator of the superconducting fluctuation. Second thing, and it's related to what I was telling you before, is related to what is the current. When we look at the electric current, we will have part which is coming from continuity equation, and part which is coming from the magnetization. Continuity equation current will have these two contributions coming from the quasi-particle and the superconducting fluctuation because they are both charged. And the part which is related to magnetization can be written just as curl of the magnetization times the generalized distribution function. Now, clearly, in order to get non-zero term here, we need some coordinate dependent coming from the Green function. If we will have something like uniform electric field, not this problem, we know that there is no contribution of the magnetization in that case, just because the Green function is going to be uniform, the gauge invariant Green function. Now when we are writing our kinetic equation, we can solve it. And we can see that we have two parts in our solution. One, if we are expanding it at low temperature, so small temperature gradient, we are calling it the local equilibrium Green function because it looks like extension of the equilibrium Green function for a non-uniform temperature. So basically, you can think about the equilibrium Green function with temperature, which depends on the coordinate, and we are now expanding that. So we are getting, that is our expansion parameter, and it will come with the derivative of our Green function. And since here, this capital R is the center of mass, it's the actual coordinate of the system, our Green function will depend on each position in space. It will be slightly different. That can give us non-zero curl of the magnetization. Now, the other part is, you can see it here, and it looks quite complicated, but I can say that it's very similar to just regular electric current. Of course, there are all kinds of details where it is not, but if I will look at the electric current, it will have a very similar effect. So the new ingredient here was that we got a contribution from the magnetization without paying. That part, if we will know how to write the Kubo formula correctly, we can get from the Kubo formula, but not the magnetization part. And of course, we don't know to write the Kubo formula, but that is all that we already discussed. So now we can, we are not doing any diagrammatic calculation, but we can, in order to connect to other, can look at our terms that we get from the kinetic equation and say what are the diagrams which are, they are correspond to. So these are the three diagrams that were important when we were looking at the superconducting fluctuation contribution to the Nernst effect, looking like the what is known as the Samazov-Larkin and the density of state diagram. We can rewrite the magnetization term that we are getting and see that it is just like magnetization of fluctuation correction to the magnetization. As I said, although we were starting from completely different method, we can connect it to all kinds of non-contributions. And now we can do our calculation. So let us look again at the Nernst effect. That is the measurement of the Nernst effect, temperature and magnetic field. We can have our own phase diagram of temperature and magnetic field, just that the magnetic field is written in terms of the cyclotron frequency for this collective mode. It is not electronic cyclotron frequency, but cyclotron frequency for the superconducting fluctuation. In the case of disordered system, they will come with the diffusion coefficient instead of 1 over m. And we can split our phase diagram into two parts. We are always looking outside of the superconducting state. We can look at the area where the cyclotron frequency of the superconducting fluctuation is larger than the temperature. So we have quantization of the fluctuation, lambda quantization of the fluctuation, no lambda quantization of the electrons, but of the fluctuation, or the area where we have almost continuous spectrum because our lambda quantization of the fluctuation spectrum is basically, there is basically it is going to the continuous limit. In addition, we can look at another two regimes that is more fine details, and I know that we have not much time, so it's not very important to describe them. But finally, before we are going to show the just final result, what is important in this calculation of thermal transport in general, specifically Peltier coefficient, is the fact that we must see that when we are going to low temperatures, since thermal current is related to the entropy, to the flow of entropy, there should not be any Nernst effect when we are going to zero temperature. Same goes to thermal transport. So that will be one of the checks that we will want to see, that we are getting zero Nernst effect at zero temperature. You can see it also here. When they are not going to zero temperature just because they can, but if we are looking at relatively high magnetic field, we can see that it starts to decay, and when they are going to low temperature, everything starts to fall down. Okay, so we have to check that. Okay, so we'll first start looking at our phase diagram and the result when we are close to TC at small magnetic field, so no quantization of our fluctuations. And we can just calculate our expression, and what we see is that we are getting something similar. There was some phenomenological calculation close to TC of the Nernst effect. We see that it coincides with that, but not with some other people try more or less the same times that we were doing our calculation to use Kubo formula, this simplified version, and they got some different answer.
Is this Gaussian fluctuation?
These are Gaussian fluctuations, yes. Now, we can fit it to the experimental data. We need, in general, two fitting parameters, TC and the diffusion coefficient. But luckily, for this niobium silicon films, from completely independent measurement, they extract both. TC is, of course, easy to extract. They extract also the diffusion coefficient. So basically, we didn't use any parameters. We were taking our equation, putting their value for the diffusion coefficient for TC, and looking at how it fits. So it looks quite well. Okay, we can go now to higher temperature, but still at low magnetic field. And we can look at our result. So that is the result. It's not very different from what we saw close to TC. Now, if part of you, some of you are familiar with fluctuation correction, Gaussian fluctuation correction, usually when we are going far from TC, they don't behave like 1 over log. They are actually logarithmic. And so here it seems to decay faster than other corrections. And the question why we are getting this more fast decay, and the reason is like that. I'm looking only at part of the current without the magnetization, we will get logarithmic contribution coming from the fluctuation correction. If we will look independently on the magnetization part, it will have the same logarithmic contribution with opposite sign. And they are exactly cancel each other. It can be shown from the terms themselves or operatorically. It's identical, really cancel identically, not approximately. Now, we will go now to the area of low temperature, and we will see that that is not some kind of coincidental cancellation. It is actually related to the third law of thermodynamics and the fact that the Nernst signal must go to zero at zero temperature. So let's go to low temperature, high magnetic field. And here, if I will look separately at this part of the current without magnetization and or the magnetization, what was previously logarithmic, it's still logarithmic, but it also comes with 1 over the temperature. That is clearly not going to cancel at zero temperature. But the same cancellation that we observed in the previous limit also holds here. So all the terms that are going with 1 over the temperature are going to cancel, and what is remaining is already linear in temperature. So it will go to zero as temperature will go to zero. And of course, it will also decay as the field over the critical field. So when we will go further far from the transition, it will decay, but if it will go to zero temperature, it will be zero, as it should be.
Is that linear in temperature dependence consistent with the experiment?
So they don't have experiment at that low temperature. The lowest temperature is not far from TC. So they don't see this kind of linear dependence. Because they are more or less here at their lowest temperature. So no.
And the low temperature is in relation to TC. That's the temperature scale of the levels.
So the low temperature?
So to see it, you want T over TC to be very small. Is that what you're saying?
So you need T over TC to be very small. Yes, that is correct.
So if you then went to high TC, you would be able to observe this at a higher temperature.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can say at high TC, they are mostly studying that with magnetic fields. So they are also never going, here it is really low temperature. 30 C is less than half Kelvin. So they are going to dilution fridge and all that. In ITC, they are also usually not getting very low temperature. They are not using any dilution fridge. So they will be, but still, yeah, it's a question whether it's linear in temperature or not. I don't know. I must admit, I don't know. In general, our result should not apply to ITC. We were using here system which is disordered system with electrons which have no gap. So if you will be the pseudo gap above TC, but in a pseudo gap, that should not apply. S wave, but the part about S wave is less crucial if you are looking at Gaussian fluctuation. The difference will be subtle, not very. But I don't know the answer whether it is linear or not. So finally, we can go at low temperature close to the transition, close to the critical field, and that is the expression that we are, expressions that we are getting. That one apply to this area, and that one we change sign apply to this area. It is not linear with temperature, but it is never, it is correct only when we are not too close to the critical point. So it's only correct at finite temperatures. Now, finally, we can take our expression and try to fit it. All the fittings that I showed you were logarithmic, so it is easy to cheat, let's say. We can use the same parameter and fit the Nernst signal, Peté coefficient, as a function of magnetic field at some arbitrary temperature coming from experiment, and just we can see that with our expression, we can capture this non-monotonous behavior of the Nernst effect. This non-monotonous behavior is actually not very complicated. Nernst effect should go with magnetic field. If we think about that, that would turn our current, and it should decay as we are going far from the transition. And when we are making the magnetic field higher and higher, we are getting more and more far from the transition for this given magnetic field. So that is basically all. I can summarize, but since it seems to be that we don't have much time, let me just remark. Okay. So instead of summarizing, let me just remark about ITC. I was saying that the motivation was ITC. I didn't show you any ITC calculation related. I didn't do any. I must admit it was somehow deviating to different directions. But what now, after doing all this detour, I must say that usually people are saying in ITC you have huge Nernst signal that persists after temperature, which is 100 plus Kelvin. But if I'm comparing it to our conventional low TC superconductors, that is maybe 3 times TC. There they see it up to 20 times TC. So if I'm just looking at how it decay with the temperature, I will say the question is not why they see Nernst effect at such high temperature, it's why they don't see it to higher temperature. So what makes it actually decay so fast? And I don't have the answer, obviously, or otherwise I'd probably change the talk. But that is somehow my puzzle now, why it actually decays so fast and not similar to the conventional superconductor persists to higher temperature. So thank you.
We have some questions here.
I have one of the puzzling things about this tube rate, anomalous Nernst effect, that it's happening at very low temperature compared to other conventional superconductors. And a very reasonable theory seems to be coming from presence of thermal vortices, which is what Anderson suggested.
Mm-hmm.
So there, he did not complain about Kubo formalism. I mean, he was focusing on the physics and said that there are these non-Gaussian fluctuations. which are very important, which can be qualitatively explained. Now, on the other hand, you are focusing on correcting Kubo's formula. Maybe there are other terms, and then you are coming to conclusion. And at the end, when you do the theory, you basically do RPE, bubble. It's like Gaussian perturbations.
It is.
So now then, where is the problem? Because the theory that Anderson advocates, for example, there he emphasizes on non-Gaussian perturbations and vertices. And so one more comment, let me come. You mentioned that niobium silicon system is like conventional superconductor. Perhaps it's far from it, because pure niobium may be a form of superconductor. But since you have a disordered system like this, I am reminded of boron group diamond.
Mm-hmm.
There you don't have good 15% of boron, but 3%. There you have superconductivity and all kinds of phenomena like this. And there the physics seems to be again back to some strong correlation physics, coming from impurity band formed by boron in diamond. So I wonder if the physics of strong correlation is coming back to your niobium silicon system, because we know that niobium 3 germanium, which is a A15 superconductor, has been called as a bad actor from electron photon interaction point of view. That you can't explain everything using BCS theory. There are serious problems.
So it seems to be personal answer that in this niobium silicon, it is can be explained quite well by BCS theory, and the doesn't seem to be any kind of new ingredient that doesn't appear in BCS theory. If you are looking at how, for example, if you are looking at, even when you are changing the amount of niobium and you are looking at how TC change with disorder, it fits quite well to what is known for BCS systems. Even if you are slightly more complicating the system, resistance looks very much like regular BCS superconductor, TC versus versus magnetic field, the curve. So if you are looking at the sharpness of the transition, so there is no reason
to... you don't suspect.
There is no, we don't have any indication that it is not. Definitely the fact that we can, doing Gaussian fluctuation.
But this anomalous non-step effect is unusual, you'd agree.
Oh,
no. Any other superconductors, other than cuprate, show this.
No, so, okay.
Anomalous non-step.
So if I'm not looking at the absolute value of the temperature, that was my comment in the end, because we were looking at Gaussian fluctuation. That is correct, which is only, you can only do that when you have weak superconductivity. So we were not even claiming that we can explain what happened in ITC. We don't even know what is the normal state there. We were assuming disordered Fermi liquid is a normal state. I don't know, if you ask me, take your formalism, even if I can apply that not for Gaussian fluctuation, I can do that. I don't know with which method, but I can probably, it's not that the formalism can use also non-Gaussian fluctuation if you know in general how to treat non-Gaussian fluctuation. And ask me, can you apply it here? I would say that what we were doing was assuming that our electrons are completely, I need some microscopic theory for that, for the superconductivity. What is the normal state of the electrons? What is the pseudo gap? Is it real gap, everything is gap, part of it is gap, or we have Fermi arcs, we have pockets. All that doesn't, all what is not known here, I cannot really even take it and calculate it. Although in principle I'm saying, if someone will give me all this information, I can. But I cannot on practical level. But if I'm looking now only at the absolute, not on the absolute temperature, but on the difference from TC. And I'm saying, it seemed to be that in both cases, the Nernst effect is related to the superconductivity. Somehow emerges from, it can be vortices in one case and Gaussian fluctuation in the other, but it is somehow related to TC. So I can ask, okay, I'm just asking, where, if I'm looking at T over TC, what is the ratio in which I'm still seeing Nernst effect? So in these conventional superconductors, it is T over TC can grow up to 20 times, can be 20. In the ITC materials.
Do you see this in other superconductors, thin film superconductors?
So
I have not seen.
So there are no measurements, I must say. That is, That is the only measurement that I know of, Nernst effect. Okay, there were measurements not in disordered systems, in quite clean systems, like aluminum, back in the 70s. And I can still use this formalism and understand why there you don't see a lot of Nernst effect, because it actually doesn't, when you have clean system, Nernst effect decay very fast. So then you actually need the disorder in order to have this kind of long-lived collective excitation that can give you the Nernst effect. So yeah, there where it is Gaussian fluctuation, we can adapt that, just take out all the what is related to impurities and get what they are getting. So, and indeed there it will decay much faster. It won't survive 20 times CC, it won't even barely survive twice CC. But so what I had in mind when I'm saying that I don't understand why now it decays so fast in the ITC materials, that if I'm assuming that it is vortices and then after that I will have fluctuation of the order parameter, of course they might behave completely differently because my normal system is not normal. But that is one point, because usually people present it as if it is giant Nernst effect that persists to very high temperature. It is correct that it is high temperature, but not high compared to TC. So that's what I had in mind.
But even the order TC, where the formula principle is supposed to be
so
the description.
Yes.
The similar is
so it seemed to be that at least, you know, it's a matter of how you interpret it, where the pseudo gap closed and all that. They almost don't see how to see it here, but they almost don't see any Nernst effect close to the in the overdoped region. So I don't know. Usually they don't, when they are showing all the curves and all the systematic measurement, it is more to the optimal doped and underdoped. But it is more interesting. I can understand that part. Why to look there? So it's a question whether you can ask still there our Gaussian fluctuation, even if it's Fermi liquid, it doesn't mean that it is weak superconductivity. So it will be described by Gaussian fluctuation. So it's probably possible to do something and estimate how it should go with temperature in this region. I didn't do anything like that, I admit. Mainly because I never saw any very systematic study of what happened in the overdoped. It's mainly they are concentrating the optimal and underdoped.
So has there been any work done in the Nernst effect in iron-based superconductors?
Measurements, you mean?
Yeah,
there are.
And is your theory work there?
So I must say that they look like they behave quite similar to what happened in the cuprate. They also decay quite fast. They also follow more or less the superconducting dome. So without having their most probably the pseudo gap, it seemed to be quite similar to what happened in the ITC.
But there are a lot of your questions that you don't have the information for the ITC, like you know it's an underlying Fermi liquid, they're breathing power.
Yes.
It's not obviously a pseudo gap like mm-hmm. behavior in some of these materials.
Okay.
So
I was not doing anything in order to try. Indeed, I can assume, let's say, that it's weak superconductivity or relatively, we know that it's some kind of intermediate superconductivity, and try just to look whether it fits. I was not trying to do that.
Okay.
Can
you
explain
one
more very stupid question? Because I'm not a condensed matter physicist. Why do you need superconductivity to have Nernst effect?
Okay, so in general, as I explained, if we have relatively high density of state of our system, it's not always, by the way, I will tell you about material where it's not superconductive.
Oh, okay, good.
You need either that your electrons will fill the bottom of the band and the fact that they're all some kind of sharp dependence of the density of state or the velocity on the energy. Basically, we saw in the beginning when we have this Boltzmann equation that the Nernst effect is proportional to some integral. We have here the density of state, derivative of the Fermi function, and energy and velocity squared. Now, if that one is constant and that one is constant, we are getting that it averages to zero. And that is, then the constant density of state is something that we can approximate when we have our spec, our, let's say, parabolic spectrum, and our Fermi energy sits more or less here. So never mind what are the dimensions of the system, the density of state is more or less constant.
Okay, so the intuition basically comes from the Fermi limit theory.
Yes. And for example, actually the record for the holding record for Nernst effect is bismuth. And bismuth is a semi-metal. And that's because the electrons are, you have, well, it has also quite complicated band structure, but electrons are more or less at the bottom of the band, and there the density of states sharply depend on the energy, and that can give you the large Nernst signal. And actually, the Nernst signal there can be explained by this formula.
It's like in general physical grounds, I mean, like with energy, Nernst effect would be there, and then, you know, for bosons.
Oh, okay, yeah. Just to condense matter, we don't know bosons unless they are mediating interactions. So, no, I'm saying, if you are thinking about electronic system, if you think about bosonic systems, that is, I would say, example of how charge bosons can give you Nernst effect. You can think about this superconducting fluctuation as charge bosons.
So, let's find the speaker again.